When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Here I am.
There you are. No matter where you go, you're always there.
That seems to be the case.
Today on the program, we'll be talking about one of the greatest things ever created in the history of the world, Doctor Who.
Ooh.
Or at least the comic books associated
okay,
with it.
Okay, Boomer.
Hey, it's still going, my friend. There is a post-millennial generation who watches Doctor Who as well.
Okay.
But first, we're going to talk about a few things going on around the comic book world that's, you know, I don't know if we'll have much to say about it, but we need something to talk about.
Yeah, nothing real exciting, is it? I mean, I'm kind of excited for one, but,
We'll see. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about Rom V.
Woo!
Rom V has signed an exclusive 2-year contract with Detective Comics Comics. Let's get your feelings first on this. How do you feel?
Obviously, as a Rom V fan, I am all giddy. You know, oh, wow, he's going to... But then it's, like you said, it's a 2-year contract. No, I mean, I think it's great. I think that Rom V has done... His work in general has... Obviously, we have one comic in particular of his and continue to be enthusiastic about. And there's another one coming out with him, the same... Him and the same artist that's hitting soon, which I'm very excited about. I think it's at Boom. Yeah, but his DC work has been great. And the Sigil, or the Signal, which is it? I can't remember now. Or the Vigil.
The Vigil.
Right. Obviously, I really love it because I remember the name. No, but the Vigil has been kind of fun.
I have not read the Vigil yet.
I think maybe 5 people are reading it, which is too bad. It's in DC continuity, but it's very much its own thing. And he's setting up some really interesting things. But his work on Justice League Dark and Swamp Thing and various other projects that he's done in the DC universe have been pretty great. And I feel like he fits well within the DC universe. And Detective has been fantastic.
I was just about to jump in there and say Detective has been amazing.
Right. And because it's really crazy, because he's almost making Batman a detective.
In Detective Comics? That does not make any sense at all.
It's a crazy idea.
I know.
So, you know, one of my very favorite writers out there is going to be writing things for the publisher that I follow the most. So, hooray.
I agree. Rom V has just been one of my favorite writers in comics for several years now. I remember reading These Savage Shores when it came out. Right. Yeah. And I was just like, who is this guy? I want more. And thankfully, there have been more. I've really loved Swamp Thing and Detective. Those things alone for DC have been amazing. I haven't read The Vigil yet. I was kind of waiting for it to.
It's an interesting, I don't know if it would be like one of my favorite comics of the year, but it's really interesting. And it's really interesting what he's doing. And he's trying to create a world within DC. This is in DC universe continuity. It feels a little bit like Stormwatch, Authority, Wildcats, that sort of thing, but with his own spin on it, because the current Wildcats is not great.
Has it ever been great?
I think Wildcats was fun at some point. I mean, the Authority and Stormwatch had their moments where they were amazing.
That's true.
And had their moments where they weren't.
That's true. My only reservation about this is I'm not a big fan of exclusive contracts. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's great for DC, and I'm sure Rom V himself is getting a meal ticket.
Think some healthcare would come with this.
Exactly. So good for them. You know, he did some really good work for Marvel. I've even read some of his Venom run, and it's quite good. Although I did read where I was afraid that like some of his independent stuff would stop, but apparently this contract doesn't exclude him from writing independent.
Right. I think most exclusive deals these days are exclusive only amongst the big two.
Right. So it's like no Marvel. So
you can't write Marvel for 2 years, but creator-owned stuff for Image, Boom, Dynamite. I don't even know what Dynamite does anymore, except like Barbarella and I don't know.
Yeah, but Vampirella, I think it is.
Vampirella, sorry. You are free to write creator-owned stuff.
Yeah, or... just stay away from our rival. Thank you very much.
But yeah, I mean, creator-owned, like, what's interesting is Jason Aaron is coming off of creator-owned, coming off of exclusive at Marvel, and he's going to have a Batman series coming up at DC.
Yeah, I know. So we got Rom V with the exclusive contract. Then we got Tom King doing Wonder Woman, and now Jason Aaron doing Batman. We could be looking at some really great comics coming up.
Maybe. I mean, the Batman that I think Jason Aaron's doing Batman in space. Like, anytime a noun is followed by in space,
it's fantastic. I mean, all you need to do is look at Leprechaun in space, and it's a classic.
Anytime something is followed by in space, I'm kind of there for it.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
It could be terrible, but it's in space.
That's right.
So it's not, you know, Jason Aaron's not writing the Batman proper, but...
Batman Black Lantern.
Yes.
I'm eagerly anticipating what's to come.
I'm hoping that he is allowed freedom. It seems like they've been letting him play in the sandbox without a whole lot of editorial ickiness. But if this is just 2 years of him writing, you know, editorially mandated crap, I'll be sad.
Yeah, I don't foresee that happening. I mean, all you need to do is look at Swamp Thing and say, yeah, they're giving him freedom here. Rombie has just been knocking it out of the park. Pretty much everything he's been doing. So, all right. Now, moving on to something that might not be good. I'm very interested to see what you have to say about this, Brian. So it turns out our dear friend, Tom Brevoort, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Brevoort.
Right, yeah, it sounded like the Swedish chef. Brevoort.
Right.
Dirty, dirty Tom Brevoort.
He makes about as much sense as the Swedish chef.
Okay, that's what I'm waiting for. So
there we have it.
So Tom Brevoort is coming off of stepping down from VP of Publishing at Marvel to take over the X-Men franchise, or kind of overseeing the new...
Editorial,
taking over. Similar to what he did with the Avengers back in the late 90s. You know, love it or hate it, he did turn that... The Avengers were sort of a middling title at that point.
They were moribund.
Yes, moribund. More or less abund. And, you know, starting with Disassembled and letting Bendis take over, he turned the Avengers into a really popular title, very money-making title. For better or worse, Civil War, Secret Invasion.
Secret War Invasion.
Yeah, so he did all that stuff. And he made it very, very popular. I have my feelings on that particular era of the Avengers. But anyway, he's going to be taking over and doing the same thing for the X-Men.
In 2024.
Yes. Thoughts?
Well, you know, I mean, okay.
Okay.
So it's no secret anybody who's listened, I don't follow the X-Men. I grew up reading the X-Men, and now I don't even know who 99% of the characters are. So it feels like, I mean, Hickman tried to write the ship, and tried to read some of the Hickman stuff, and I was like, oh no, see, we were promised that this was a good jumping on point for those of us who had abandoned the X-Men. Oh no, it wasn't. Not even close. It wasn't. The novice readers, like myself, tried to read the Hickman run and was like, nope, no idea. None of this means anything to me. I don't know who these people are. Nothing.
Okay, so I'm always hot and cold on the X-Men. I jump in, I jump out, I try to catch up, but I loved Hickman's run. I really did. I was very skeptical about it at first, but then, you know, he got all charts and graphs and you know, he got all Hickman on that shit, and it was great.
Sure, I'm sure for anybody who even knew who any of the characters were, enjoyed it.
Yeah. No, I really liked it. And this is just me speculating here. I haven't read anything that is confirming this, but this is just me. I see Brevoort coming on, because he's also working with Kevin Feige, who in In addition to running the MCU, he's also head of comics right now too.
Right.
Or what, I don't know what his title, head of comics.
Busy selling.
Yeah. He's overseeing that. And as we all know, the X-Men will be starting in the MCU pretty soon. So Brevoort coming on and doing what he did with the Avengers and doing it for the X-Men and kind of streamlining it and making it more economically friendly, let's say.
And here is where I actually, so you hit on the one thing where I am actually going to be positive.
Ooh, very good.
Yeah. Mr. Pork Pie Hat may actually finally may make the X-Men readable.
So, yeah, because I couldn't see translating Hickman into a financially lucrative movie franchise.
Right.
As much as I love Jonathan Hickman, he's a bit on the complicated side of things. So I can see Brevoort coming in and, you know, streamlining everything, making it basically, let's start at zero or start at X and then move on up. Yeah.
And as much as my personal distaste of the gentleman in question, if anybody can do it, maybe it is him.
Yes. And, you know, personalities aside, you know, he's been in comics since 89. I mean, he's had a hand in a lot of things. He's got experience and, you know, love him or hate him, he knows what he's doing.
Sort of. I mean, it's, you know, he fumbled the Fantastic Four thing low these many years ago.
Yeah.
And has fumbled a few things, but he's a company man. And for good or ill, and I have reservations about the idea of the X-Men being streamlined so that they can fit into the movies. And I have a lot of issues with comics writing for the movies as a general rule. And I think Marvel has sinned more than DC about this, but yeah. DC has its sins as well. So I'm not excusing either of them. But, you know, if Bregroot,
I am Bregroot.
I am Bregroot. Can make the X-Men readable to me once again, then I'm willing to give it a shot.
You know, I see it more as to think that that there isn't a plan going on right now for launching the X-Men in the movies or TV or whatever, however they're going to do it. That's foolish. They have something in the works, no doubt. Yeah. And I think they just want the comics to fall in line with that because they're going to try to make money. They're going to try to sell as many X-Men comics as they can in anticipation of launching these movies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the synergy of the Disney Corporation does.
I just read through the Hellfire Gala, the latest one that came out. What a hot mess. And so, like, I tried to read it because I was like, aren't these supposed to be resetting points? So I read the latest one and I was like, nope, I'm out. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Hickman reset everything to a central point, and then like within months, it just blew out into tentacles of X-Men everywhere. Yeah, it's very hard to, at least for me, it's very hard to keep up with all the different titles of the X-Men and what the continuity is and whatnot. So I choose not to.
If my nemesis, who doesn't know that he's my nemesis and doesn't even know who I am, can streamline the once proud series, then good for him.
I can totally see starting with that original team again and growing it from there. Anyway, we'll see. Yeah.
His one job I will be watching for.
Yes. Redeem the beast.
And if they don't redeem the beast, then I'm done forever. Forever and all of the days going forward into eternity.
Oh, we should make a t-shirt. Redeem the beast. No context, just redeem the beast.
Redeem the beast.
And again, you have a personal disdain, maybe?
Yeah.
For Mr. Swedish Chef.
Well, there are reasons, and there are good reasons.
Yeah, I mean, he's done some questionable... Yeah, he's made some questionable comments over the years. I just try to take a step back from that and just
think, he hurt my DC feelings.
That's right. And that means he's evil and must be stopped at all costs. Animosity is the way of things now.
Yes.
You're either for us or against us. So anyway, so we heard about Jeff Smith, creator of Bone, and
just today. So by the time this posts, it'll be older news. But
yeah, he'll be up and around by the time this posts. So Jeff Smith had a little bit of a heart attack.
Yeah, a cardiac event, which has sidelined all of his plans. There was supposed to be some new Jeff Smith stuff coming out. And so that is sidelined as of immediately from Cartoon Books. Jeff Smith had, he's recovering.
Yeah, so apparently he's recovering, and the report I read. His bones are solid. So apparently he's doing well. He's in stable condition. So best wishes to Mr. Jeff Smith. We were talking about this before we started. When I heard that he had a heart attack, I was like, oh, he's too young to have a heart attack. And then I realized, oh, he's 63. which is still young, but
not because it's a very serious situation. We want Jeff Smith to be well and get back to giving us more comics and selfishly get back to giving us more comics.
Yeah.
But as members of the human race, we want this great creator to be well. And it sounds like he's recovering, but it's going to be a long road.
No, but I just I just in my mind think he's perpetually 27 years old.
Creators that we grew up with have not aged in the same way that we have.
Exactly. Because I haven't aged in the same way that I have. I still think I'm 27, and then I look in the mirror and go. Comic
book creators follow the same aging pattern as the characters that they're writing.
Now, there are many times where I look in the mirror and go like, who the hell is that guy? Who's that old guy? but anyway, no, Jeff Smith, we wish you well, recover. And we'll get to see some more Jeff Smith stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's it.
Those are the topics we have.
Those are the topics.
Even though that we somehow managed to still have opinions.
Exactly.
Whether they're relevant or not.
What, our opinions?
Yeah.
Or the topics?
We're the collected edition. We have spoken.
Well, we're very interesting guys, Brian. We are really interesting in our own minds.
Exactly.
We're just waffling at this point. Let's just take a break and come back and talk about, again, one of the greatest things in the world.
Who?
Exactly.
And we're back. Hooray. So for today's exciting podcast, we will be discussing Paul's Recommendation, which is a series of Doctor Who comics. Paul, tell us about Doctor Who.
Okay, here we go. On Saturday, November 23rd, 1963, at approximately 16 minutes and 20 seconds past 5 p.m., the greatest cultural achievement ever created by human beings premiered on British television in the form of a half-hour serialized science fiction drama called Doctor Who. The premise was a simple one. A curmudgeonly old alien called the Doctor and his various companions travel through time and space in a blue box that's bigger on the inside and have exciting adventures. Originally conceived of as an educational program, think Magic School Bus, but quickly, it morphed into a sci-fi space opera with iconic recurring villains and morality play storylines. It became immensely popular. Now, when the original actor to play the Doctor, William Hartnell, became too ill to continue in the role, the producers were faced with either casting a look-alike actor or canceling the show. But instead, they came up with one of the most innovative solutions in the show's history, and one that would prove crucial to its longevity. The Doctor, you see, was an alien that had the ability to regenerate. In times of old age or fatal injury, the Doctor could change every molecule in their body and become an entirely new person with an entirely new personality. This allowed a new actor to take over and play the Doctor however they saw fit, and the show could do a soft reboot every 3 to 4 years or so. It was genius. Now, in the mid-70s, the fourth actor to take on the role, Tom Baker, started his tenure and soon became, arguably, the most iconic incarnation of the Doctor. With his toothy grin, manic personality, and ridiculously long scarf, Tom Baker embodied the role of the Doctor for 7 series and became the image of what most people think of when they think of Doctor Who. During Tom Baker's run, the series was at the height of its popularity, at least until the modern revival. And in 1978, Marvel UK obtained the rights to publish Doctor Who comics, and a magazine, Doctor Who Weekly, debuted. The magazine contained interviews and behind-the-scenes features, as well as an ongoing comic. Now, Doctor Who comics had been published since the 1960s, but these were more cartoonish and aimed at a younger audience. In Doctor Who Weekly, the comics were changed to a, quote, American style, unquote, and the target audience was up to a more mature demographic, teens rather than kids. And up-and-coming artists and writers were brought on to create new stories, most of whom were already veterans of another iconic British comics magazine, 2000 AD. Among these writers were Pat Mills and John Wagner, known for Judge Dredd, among other things, and a young artist named Dave Gibbons, who would go on to a pretty decent career in comics. The team created some of the most beloved stories of the time, two of which we'll be talking about today. I chose these comics, The Star Beast and The City of the Damned, for several reasons. First of all, they're very silly, very goofy, and at times can be crude and almost amateurish in the way they're presented, much like the television show they're based on. But there are themes that appear here that resonated with me as a kid and still resonate with me today. Things like freedom of thought and expression are not only needed, but are important to how we live our lives. The idea that the hero is not always the cute one, and the villain not always the one who seems monstrous and ugly. That the winner is not determined by who is the strongest or who has the biggest gun, but rather who is the cleverest and who can outthink their opponent. I fell in love with Doctor Who, and still love it to this day, because it prioritizes intelligence and romanticism over violence and cynicism. It's earnest and genuine and sweet. To sum up what it means, I'll quote the Doctor himself. Never be cruel, never be cowardly. Remember that hate is always foolish and love is always wise. Always try to be nice and never fail to be kind. And if that sentiment is silly and goofy, well, so be it. Brian, what did you think of the Doctor Who comics we read?
Well, now I'm feeling bad about a certain Marvel editor from previously.
These are aspirational. Doesn't always work.
So I think it should be noted and has been hinted at probably vaguely. I don't know a damn thing about Doctor Who.
That's okay.
I watched an episode here or there as a kid when it would pop up on PBS when I had sneakily stayed up later than I was supposed to, but never engaged in the Whoville or Whoverse or Betty Lou Who or whatever.
Yeah, Brian hears a Who.
I did hear a Who. I am one of the, I realize I have to turn in some of my cred here in this podcast to say, Doctor Who? I do know Tom Baker. That's, and per your introduction, Tom Baker is the one that I always view as when I think of Doctor Who.
Yes, as do most non-Whovians.
And I understand that there are Doctor Who's currently or have been currently who are more beloved in some ways. David Tennant, I think, being one of those.
Matt Smith is another one who's getting big.
So I'm approaching this literally ignorant.
And that's okay.
And there's still parts of this I was like, I don't know what they're talking about. In some of this, I think there's references and Easter eggs and things that I'm like, I don't know. But that did not, I think, affect my enjoyment of these two separate story arcs. I enjoyed them. I think what you said is they're goofy as hell. It's just kooky stuff. I don't mean that negatively. So the long way around, I enjoyed these.
Okay, so I am a fan. I have been a fan since I was 8 years old. Again, watching it on PBS. For me, I mean, it's not like when you watch those earlier episodes, the classic run from the 60s and 70s and 80s. I mean, they're very cheap. I am not unaware of the program's flaws, or as I like to call it, the charm of the show.
Well, and I was talking to a coworker who is a big Doctor Who fan. He may actually, this is a different coworker than our regular listener, This is a different one. And I said, hey, you're going to have to listen to the podcast for the first time because we're doing Doctor Who. He got very excited. And, but, you know, he kind of filled me in on some things, like you were talking about how cheap the production looked. And, you know, he was like, well, you know, he gave me history and it was all about, you know, the budget. and they literally had no budget.
Yeah, I believe the budget for those early episodes was roughly 100 pounds, a pile of styrofoam, and some duct tape.
I mean, they started off with a budget, but as the series went on, it got cheaper looking. As each contained series went on, it got cheaper looking as the budget filtered away.
Yeah, it ebbed and flowed. There was a little bit of background history. There was a woman in Britain named Mary Whitehouse, and she was, I think the technical term is awful, just a terrible person. She was one of those moral majority people who tried to, you know, what about the children? And she had it in her bonnet to go after Doctor Who about how it was ruining kids and scarring them for life. And so you can see a distinctive drop in the 70s because the producers just pulled away, you know, or the BBC just pulled away, and would not give money. And it just, yeah, it went downhill for quite a while as far as how it looked. The stories were still pretty good.
But what's great is in the comics medium,
you don't need a budget.
You do. your writers and artists, but they seem to have lucked on, as you again alluded in your intro, to an artist who may have some skill.
And you can see it because this is really early on in Gibbon's career, so you can see what will become. But he's still a little not perfect yet.
This really felt 2000 AD to me.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And I was confused at first because, of course, it starts with Stan Lee Presents.
Right, because this is...
And then I'm reading it, and I was like, I'm sitting there going, I don't remember these comics from when I was growing up. And then there says Stan Lee Presents. And, you know, of course, I had to find out that these were written for the UK.
Yes, the Marvel UK.
Marvel UK.
They were eventually released here in these collections, but it never really took off here. When I was watching Doctor Who as a kid, it was like mine. You know, it was one of those things like no one in my school watched Doctor Who, at least that I knew of. It was just like my own little personal thing where I could watch it on PBS. I felt like I was the only one who knew what this show was. And it wasn't until much later in life that I realized, oh, other people like this too.
You have a community.
Now, the revival has become quite globally popular, which I'm okay with. Yeah, I mean, and the fact that quote I read at the end of the introduction is from Peter Capaldi's Doctor. Peter Capaldi is absolutely fantastic as the Doctor. He's just absolutely fantastic.
I know him from other roles where he's very curmudgeonly and...
Yeah, he is very curmudgeonly. someone did a mashup of the Doctor, scenes of the of him playing the Doctor, but dialogue from The Thick of It, which is very, very funny. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know the show, The Thing of It. It's where he curses all the time.
Oh, is this the political satire that also had James Gandolfini?
Yeah, well, that was the movie. They had a movie. But it was also a television series as well.
Okay, so I know the movie that he's in, and Gandolfini and some other really great actors and actresses. So, yeah. So that was probably one of my first experiences with Capaldi was that. And I was like, this guy's amazing.
Yes, yes. But anyway... What was I going to say? Oh, so, you know, I'm not unaware of it's not always perfect, but it's just one of those things. I just love it. I just love the show. And its message is always good. Like the Doctor never uses a weapon because he's better than that.
Doesn't he have a screwdriver? He references a screwdriver.
He has a sonic screwdriver. Now the sonic screwdriver, to anyone who doesn't know, it started out as just that. It was a screwdriver that sonically unscrewed things, and it was just supposed to be this one-off thing, but then it sort of became, you know, it could unlock doors, and then it could, you know, whenever he was fixing a machine, he could wave his sonic screwdriver and magically fix things, to the point where in the newer episodes, the newer revival, it's become like a magic wand. You can just wave it around and scan things, and you know, I have a feeling they're going to start scaling it back and saying, you know what, maybe this is too much of a catch-all thing now. But anyway, that's sort of his thing. It's his magic wand.
Oh, well, everybody has a magic wand.
Yes. And of course, these comics reference jelly babies, which are jelly beans.
Right.
And the Fourth Doctor would always have a bag of jelly babies with him.
Okay.
That was his go-to. Whenever he was in trouble, he'd say, would you like a jelly baby?
Yes, he kept, so I kind of caught that was jelly babies, I was assuming. So throughout the comic, they referenced the jelly babies a lot.
And for the most part, Yes, there are a couple of little throwaway gags, but you don't really need to know Doctor Who continuity. And the thing about Doctor Who is, because it's time and space, they change stuff all the time. Throughout the years, they've gone to Atlantis like 3 times, and it's always different, because who cares?
Well, you know, I mean, if you're traveling through time, you know, things change. You know,
time is fluid.
Constant, right, so.
Yeah, the rules change all the time. So. Anyway, let's talk about the actual comics themselves. I kind of like the fact that you don't know a lot of the Doctor Who history, so I can get an unbiased opinion of what these are. So let's start with City of the Damned.
Okay.
Which is good.
That's the one I read first, so that's the... Yeah. That's my notes for that are on top. Very convenient.
Written by Wagner and Mills and artist Dave Gibbons. It's set in a dystopian society where all emotion has been removed from the population in order to make it a peaceful, nonviolent society. But of course, it's boring and nothing happens. And the Doctor sort of, as is his wont, he materializes into a situation and just makes a mess of everything. What was your initial thoughts on this story?
Well, gosh. I mean, obviously there's a serious message underlying all this, which is about emotion and suppression and fascism and people with brains for heads.
Yes, the brain trust.
Literally. Yeah, I mean, it's fun, right? And there's numerous Marx Brothers references, which I'm all for.
We'll get to Zeppo very soon. Okay, so the Doctor comes in. The first thing he sees is a husband and wife, A and B, sitting and having their paste for breakfast and having just the most generic conversation. And it's very Big Brother. You know, obviously this is 1984.
There's a moderator general.
The moderator general on a big screen saying, live in harmony, and everyone. Again, this one felt extremely 2000 AD to me.
Way more than the next one. But because this was the first one I read, I was like, I was expecting Judge Dredd any minute.
Yes, exactly. By the way, just so you know, these early Doctor Who comics were not only written by Wagner and Mills, there were other couple of writers on it. Alan Moore, Grant Morrison, and Neil Gaiman all wrote for this as well.
Yeah.
So there's a pretty, these were all very early in their careers, obviously.
Vertigo was taking notes.
So very quickly, the Doctor is noticed because he's a very, as we'll find out, very emotive human being. Well, not human being, being, let's just say. And he is taken to the Citadel where he is, his emotions are going to be expunged. And some hilarious little bits of comedy happen.
Dunking is not permitted.
Exactly. I really would like a box that materializes coffee and donuts.
But that was that was one of my favorite, you know, humorous moments was, you know, it's like Doctor Who materializes, like you just said, a box of donuts while he's being sort of attacked or whatever by the moderators, who are the ones that they're the military force that enforces no emotions, you know. So he's trying to ask them, hey, these are really good if you dunk them, and you know, he gets whacked upside the head.
Yeah, they just knock it all out of his hands. It's like, right. dunking is not permitted.
This is one of the greatest lines in comic book history.
Exactly. So the Doctor is going to be strapped down and have his emotions removed from the from a emotion removing machine.
Right, because he's viewed as a threat.
He's viewed as a threat, yeah. Because he has a lot of emotions. But he is saved at the last minute by Zom Emotional People's Organization, or Zeppo. Love that they come flying in with, like, they have propellers on their backs and little wings strapped to their arms. And that's how they fly around. So they come flying in and they save the Doctor. And again, this is...
They're saving it, by the way, from the Ultra Harmonizer. Like, some of the names for these things. So they have, you know, if you're irredeemable and you have too much emotion, you get sent to the Feeler's Gate, through the Feeler's Gate, which is where you get killed. And then there's a Harmony Booth that people have to go in. If they start feeling emotions, they have to go into the Harmony Booth. And then, like, what they're going to hook Doctor Who up to is the Ultra, or what is it again? The Ultra Harmonizer, which will, yes, brainwash, you know, it just wipes your mind clean.
I do have to say one thing, because there are going to be people who are furiously typing in the comments, he's just the Doctor, he's not Doctor Who.
Okay, yes.
It's important. You
know, I'm calling him Doctor Who. I'm not, it's fine,
listeners. It's just the Doctor.
I know this. Doctor Who.
No, you're going to make everyone angry.
Well, you know, actually,
you know, he's just called the Doctor.
Who is?
Exactly. So Zeppo, everyone in Zeppo has one emotion that they practice. They choose one emotion so that they can keep it around. And when people begin to feel again, they can teach them this emotion. That's very Fahrenheit 451, where everyone has one story that they keep saying over and over. You know, and it's like the harmonizer, it's very Sleeper. There's a lot of old ideas that they're sort of mixing and mashing together.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Should we go through some of the Zeppo people?
Humble, who literally is a bootlicker, like he tries to lick Doctor Who's boots.
Yes. So there's very angry. They're all known by the emotion. There's very angry,
slightly angry. There's three angries.
Yeah, very angry, slightly angry, and fairly angry. Half deft. he's a little bit nutty. So the doctor is carted away. They see that he's an emotional guy, and they take him back to the Zeppo campgrounds. I would like to say, you know, there's a great action scene. It's not really a great action scene. They just sort of, it's very goofy. They're flying around. They look like they're all being crucified. Because they have wings under their arms, and they have to spread out and keep their legs together to use like a tail. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but
yeah, no, I mean, it's Gibbons and the writers, to go back to the characters, like we're only listing part of them, the cast of characters, even the ones that you only see, you know, in the crowd or whatever, are so wonderfully created individually. It's really artistically great that what Gibbons does. And we know Gibbons is great at sort of the background that says more than the foreground. I mean, he has one comic in particular that he excelled with.
I'll have to watch for that.
More or less. You know, this really shows that this is a skill that he's definitely has had for a while. It's wonderful. Like, you just look at some of these panels and you could just stare at them for minutes to try to pick out all the different emotions and the characters and how he's representing them.
And each of the characters has their own, you know, you can see their personalities in their face. It's very, nothing's a throwaway. Like Nervous has a box over his head and on it is written, Nervous is in or out.
I couldn't tell if it was Forbush Man or not.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Yeah. So, and then the character Mournful is more, he reads from the book of the late leader Hopeful, and there's a prophecy that the great emoter will come to save them. And of course, the doctor is seen as the great emoter because he has so many emotions. And they're all very excited when he becomes angry and sad and happy, all within the space of a half an hour.
Yeah, they can't wrap their minds around. He has so many emotions.
Exactly. They're beginning to see him as sort of a messiah type figure until the cult of big hate comes.
There's big tobacco, there's big government, and there's big hate.
Yeah, so big hate comes. So it's a whole group of people who have decided to embrace hate as their emotion.
But he's on, but they, like what I love is like they're actually on Zeppo's side.
But they don't believe that Zeppo is.
But they're a more extreme sect. But they don't come, they don't show up to, like, you know, battle with Zeppo.
Yes, I'm sure there's no political allegories we could come up with.
No, not at all.
Not at all, not at all. I'm sure this was just, because there are no messages in comics.
No.
Barbara the Bloodbug?
Barbara the Bloodbug! Which I thought, at first, you know, I thought, oh, it's just one blood. But no, they're all Barbaras.
Yes, they're all Barbaras. So and anyway,
I believe they're referred to in the billion. Billions of Barbaras. Barbaras for me. Billions of Barbaras. Barbaras for free. Someone will get that.
Okay. Yeah. So Big Hate arrives and they have been breeding Barbara blood bugs, which will strip a organic body to a skeleton within seconds. They're kind of like piranhas of the land.
One of the chapters in this is called Night of the Barbara. Night of the Bar. I was so happy.
Big Hate has decided to release the Barbaras upon the city, thinking that they have trained it to only eat the moderators. But of course, the Barbaras don't care. They're just going to eat anybody.
So the Barbaras won't eat the doctor.
The Barbaras won't eat the doctor because
Doctor Who.
The Barbaras will die. Adrenaline is poison to them, and they will die. So if you're feeling emotion, especially fear or anxiety or anger, your adrenaline goes up. The Barbaras bite into you, and they will die immediately because they don't like adrenaline.
Adrenaline is poison to the Barbaras. We've all known a Barbara like that.
Nothing can survive Barbara. The big hate has come. That is a good line. So the Barbaras are released into the city, and the doctor has to get everyone to start feeling emotion again.
Otherwise, the entire populace will die.
Exactly. And we get some it's kind of disturbing, but really funny at the same time, where you have people just sitting there and the barbers are surrounding their bodies and stripping them to bone. And they're just like, oh my goodness, they seem to be eating me.
It's a horrific image, but it's also a hilarious visual gag.
It is.
I say, we seem to be being eaten.
Shall we do anything? No, I believe we'll be fine. Yeah, so, and there's some really, again, Dave Gibbons, man. I mean, there's like skeletons with these kind of Jory LaForge visors on them, because all the moderators wear these little strip visors like Jordy LaForge. So the doctor swoops in. He has to get to, and we didn't talk about, there's the group that runs the city is the Brain Trust, which are people with brains for heads.
Yes. And they are introduced earlier. I think I referenced them before, but
they're
the ones in charge. Like, so the head moderator or whatever is sort of the enforcer and the visual sort of big brother, but it's the Brain Trust literally in the background who are running things.
I do want to point out that, so these comics are pretty short. They're only a few pages each chapter, that is.
Right.
And they always end with a cliffhanger, which is how the classic series always ended. So the classic series wasn't just one episode, one and done episodes. It was done like a serial, like a movie serial. So it would be like anywhere.
Movie serials, one should note that the thing that happens in the last panel of the end of the chapter isn't actually what happens in the next.
And that is very much like the TV show. So it always has to end on a cliffhanger. Sometimes it's a little bit too much. There's one, we got to this one page where the doctor looks into the screen or looks at the viewer and says, nothing can save the city of the damned.
I wrote that down too. I was like, yes.
Nothing can save them except for when you get to the next page. And then, yes, he does save the city of the damned. Yeah, so the blood bugs are overrunning the city and just, they say there's billions of them and they continue to, I guess they're like tribbles.
Yeah.
But they have to get the people to emote. They go, the doctor makes his way. Pretty interesting. It's very fun. He gets
teleports.
He gets this teleporter and he keeps teleporting into the wrong spot until he gets it. So it's a very funny little montage of him teleporting into different areas. I don't think I've gotten it yet. Oh, I've gotten it now. And he finally teleports into the Brain Trust. And explains everything to them. And they basically say, okay, let's just do that then.
Right. Let's just, I mean, it was like, I think it took him like, 50 words to talk the Brain Trust into giving people emotions back. I mean, it's a good argument. He's saying, hey, you're trying to protect, because the city was formed because there was a very violent group of people beforehand. And the only way to like get rid of the violence was in their minds, in their brains, to strip everything of emotion, therefore getting rid of, religion. I think they referenced like religion and, various other things. But they were very easy to convince to just give everybody emotions back. It's because the argument was, you're designed to protect these people. You are not protecting them right now. They will all die if you don't give them emotions back.
And they did, the Brain Trust was like, you know what? It'll destroy everything we've built, but it's better than the alternative.
Have at it.
So the decision is made to give the emotions back, but the head moderator or the moderator general is just, he's a fanatic. And he says, no, you can't do that. So he kills the Brain Trust and won't allow the emotions to be given back. And so the doctor has to, trick people into believing that they can get their emotions back.
Yeah. He knocks out the moderator, impersonates the moderator, and tells everybody to get back into the harmony booths.
And when they get back into the harmony booth, their emotions are returned to them.
And the city is saved.
And
everybody's happy. And
well, the punchline, of course, is that the doctor put his emotions into the harmony booth so that everybody got his emotions using the booths. And then you see in the last panel, everyone has long scarves and is jumping around and eating jelly babies and playing with yo-yos. And the doctor says, I suppose they'll grow out of it.
But like my final note on this was no implications.
This is an ongoing thing in Doctor Who fandom. So a lot of times the doctor will go into a situation and basically completely alter their society and then say, bye. And well, what happens now?
And that's what I was like at the end of it. I was like, you just gave an entire planet or an entire city or an entire civilization emotions back. And then you just kind of walk away, figure it out. I mean, these people will start shooting each other any minute now.
Well, theoretically, they're all like the doctor, so they'll start being kind and caring and try to help each other.
But if they're all like the Doctor, then, you know, the Doctor only has a specific set of skills, right? So
no, the Doctor has all the skills.
But how do you organize then as a society after this? I realize I'm way overthinking this.
Congratulations, you've just entered Doctor Who fandom. Way overthinking things is what we do. But no, this is very, you know, overall, this story is a lot of fun, I think. Obviously, it's an allegory for, you know, free will, freedom of expression, and so forth.
Right.
In the late 70s and 80s, it seemed that British comics and music were really against the whole fascism thing.
I wonder why.
Yeah, so there was a punk rock mentality that went through a lot of British subculture.
Well, and of course, they were like right smack dab into Thatcherism at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Not Thatcher herself, but, you know, both the lead up to Thatcherism and the actual Thatcherism. So,
yeah. Yeah. Thatcherism was just beginning. Yeah. I mean, I can't pretend to know the history of the UK at this time, just from what I have read. Yeah. I mean, thank goodness the US didn't go through anything like that.
No, yeah, luckily we've avoided that both throughout most of the 80s and currently.
Now we pause for a deep sigh.
Weary sigh.
So obviously this is, they're trying to keep the story very light and airy, but they're talking about some serious issues, which is what comics should do all the time.
Yeah, and I think done in ways that it's interesting because this was made for the UK and it is using, you know, 2000 AD alumni, or not necessarily alumni at that time, probably still existing 2000 AD. I don't know the history of, I think Pat Mills and Wagner and Gibbons wrote for 2000 AD for a lot.
Oh, yes, for quite a while.
And I think still sometimes revisit, you know, it's hard to keep track of 2000 AD sometimes, although I think it's one of the great comics out there. But fascism in general is such a common theme, and not just fascism, and I'm using fascism generically, not necessarily
authoritarianism.
Right. I mean, there's definitional differences in the usage of those words, and I'm using them very generically. But that just, like you said, that is so prevalent. And you see that even when these British writers would come to the States and be writing comics in the States.
Oh, yeah.
You would see that carry over in ways that a lot of comic book writers, like U.S.-born, U.S.-raised comic book writers, didn't have as strong a grasp on, at least initially. So it's deep stuff couched in very sort of broad humor.
Yes, it's very broad slapstick humor. And, you know, and keep in mind, Doctor Who is a kid's show. It was very much geared towards children. Now, adults became fans over the years, and some of the themes and storylines became more mature. But it still has that, you know, we're for kids. And this comic does the same thing. This is, you know, like I said in the introduction, it is geared towards mostly teens. They're trying to keep it kid-friendly, while at the same time talking about 2000 AD themes and ideas. So it walks a very fine line. And I personally think it does it really well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I do. This was a very interesting read for me. And again, even though there's a lot of stuff I don't know, whereas I think the next comic doesn't seem to have as much of the overriding political or societal themes, but is just a hoot.
It is a hoot. This is much more comedy based, but it does. And again, I talked about this in the introduction. This is an ongoing thing from the inception of Doctor Who right up until today, which is don't judge someone by how they look. So the Star Beast begins with a spaceship crash landing in Black Castle. So we have the spaceship crash lands, and it is found by two precocious young students, Sharon and Fudge. And again, we had talked about this before we started recording, but the dialect writing in here, cool, blimey. So it's a bit excessive, I think.
I think probably very intentional.
Yes, I'm sure. You know, it's very Dickinsonian. You know, I expected the Artful Dodger to pop out. Okay. Come on, Gov. But they stumble upon this and they find this adorable little blue creature called Meep. He just sits there. He's a big blue fuzzball with big ears.
You just want to give it a hug.
Yeah, he's got big eyes and he's meep meep.
Crying because he's sad. And he big giant eyes with these tears coming out and this little blue fur. And
yeah, so obviously he's a nice, sweet little thing and the kids want to help him. Meanwhile, in space, The Doctor materializes on a spaceship that is controlled by these giant bug-like creatures.
Horrifying-looking things. Clearly the evil big bads of the story.
Obviously. And the Doctor comes out in typical Doctor fashion, wearing a sombrero. So it should be noted that not only in these two stories, but pretty much every story in this run, the Doctor is attempting to get to Spain, which is Benidorm.
Yes. And I asked you about this off camera, as it were. I was like, is this a thing? Because it seems like he keeps trying to get to the same place.
Yes, it is. So one of the first, probably the first comic in this Doctor Who Weekly run. By the way, Doctor Who Weekly eventually became Doctor Who Monthly and is still running to this day. Yeah, it's still going. Yeah, so he's trying to go to Spain to have a vacation. And this is kind of a running, so like the third Doctor, John Pertwee, the third Doctor, always wanted to go to Metabilis 3. And throughout his tenure, he's always talking about going to this planet that he never gets to go to. So it's kind of like a running thing.
Can you pronounce for me the name of the bug-like aliens?
Maybe.
They're the W-R-A-R-T-H Warriors. The Worth Warriors. They're the Worth Warriors.
They're the Worth, for what it's worth. I would say the Worth. It's a very, I think this is very, very fun comedic thing where comes out of the TARDIS wearing his, by the way, TARDIS, time and relative dimensions in space. Just so you know, that's what TARDIS means. He comes out wearing a sombrero with K-9. K-9 is a character in the show.
Oh, okay.
Or at least he was. It was a little robot dog that he had for a while.
And there's a humorous running bit with K-9.
It's very interesting. During Tom Baker's run, he had K-9 and it was this little prop. It's a prop, and it's very cute, but it's also very hard to control. And all throughout his tenure, there would be things of like, oh, K-9's he's broken today, or he has to stay behind on the show. It's always these ways of trying to get K-9 out of the story. it actually becomes really funny after a while when you rewatch these things. Oh, yep, they're sidelining K-9 again. Anyway, it's very dark in this spaceship, and the Doctor goes to turn on a light. And he starts twisting a little knob, and it turns out it's an eyeball of one of the Worth. Oh, terribly sorry. I'm squeezing your eyeball, aren't I? So, yes, they have these menacing, giant, bug-like creatures. They shoot K-9, and they grab the Doctor with their hand tongues. Yeah, so it looks like these guys are just horrible. They want to kill the Meep.
Right. They're these evil creatures who are coming after the Meep, and so they automatically assume that Doctor Who is with the Meep.
He must be, yes.
Because, of course.
He's ugly. He has a skeleton on the inside. It's disgusting. So they surgically implant a bomb in his belly, as you do, so that when he gets close to the Meep, they'll just explode. He'll blow it up and kill the Meep. Doctor is allowed to escape. Meanwhile, Meep is being helped by Fudge and Sharon. They're treating him like a pet, basically, which will come into play soon. The Doctor's allowed to escape. He finds out that K-9 thinks he's a cat now, which is just ridiculous. I do like the fact that he gets down on hands and knees and tries to teach K-9 what a dog does. He does, of course, find out that that the Meep's ship has crashed, and he goes to find out what's going on, as per what Dr. Do does. Dr. Do? What the Doctor does, he goes and investigates, and he protects Earth from alien invasion.
And so, of course, he meets up with Sharon and Fudge. What happens? So, like, the Worth try to attack Sharon and Fudge, and the Doctor saves them. I'm sorry, the Doctor Who saves them. And so, but then, like, he's like, oh, I have a tummy ache. And so then, suddenly, out of nowhere, he realizes, there must be a bomb inside my stomach.
Putting two and two together. He's an alien that's been alive for thousands of years, of course. It was an easy escape. I have a tummy ache. I must have a bomb inside me.
I must have a bomb in my stomach. I mean, when I have a tummy ache, that's the first thing I think.
Exactly. He quickly neutralizes that threat by wrapping his tummy in lead that he gets from a woman's roof.
Right. Mrs. Higgins, who is the mother of Fudge.
We start to find out that Meep isn't what he seems. We start to hear Meep's internal monologue. He just keeps wishing everyone death. I will destroy you all.
Right.
You will tremble in my presence.
We could see this coming from a mile away.
Meep and the Worath. Let's go with Worath. How about that?
Sure.
There's an A in there too. Okay, we'll call them the Brevroot. So they all get together, and suddenly Meep pulls a gun from his belly pouch, as one does, and he shoots one of the Worath. So we find out that Meep isn't exactly what he seems. Then there's a very funny bit, I think, where the Doctor and Fudge and Sharon try to escape with Meep on a bus?
Yes, that's one of my notes is, they all take public transportation.
No animals are allowed on the bus without a lead, so they have to put a leash on Meep.
And in perfect public transportation mode, you have the thought of one of the people sitting on the bus saying, I hope they don't sit next to Meep.
And for putting a leash on him, Meep thinks that there will be atonement in blood for this humiliation. But then we find that, let's just skip ahead. We find that the Wrath is, they're sort of a police force, and that the Meep is actually the head of a race of Meeps that have been conquering various planets.
Peaceful, but then they were exposed to a black sun and then became these universal conquerors.
Yes, they went from peaceful to a warmongering race.
I do feel I need to interject here for one little important piece. When they're on the bus, like the doctor who realizes that they left Fudge and his mother behind, so he leaves Sharon and Meep on the bus and then goes back to Mrs. Higgins and Fudge's home, and they've been captured by the Wrath. So the doctor just kind of comes in and he sits down and because he suspects something's off. And so he just sits down and is like, hey, let's talk about this. So while they're chatting about it and the Wrath are telling him all about what you just alluded to, the history of the Meeps, he was like, oh my God, it's I've left Sharon alone with the Meep. And so, it's very concerning. He's like, well, we're going to have to rescue her. But they make sure that they have their tea and cake first.
Well, they're not uncivilized, Brian.
I love this. It's like, oh no, this woman is in danger, but we'll have our tea and cake before we go rescue. That's one of my favorite parts of the comic is like, oh, tea and cake.
Well, yes. Like I said, they're not barbarians.
Not monsters.
Yes. And the tea was just put on. So yes, you get the history of the Meeps over tea and cakes. And then the doctor has to go and rescue them because the Meep is trying to get back to his ship, which is powered by a mini black sun. And it's basically a black hole. So they're going to try to take off from Earth, which will destroy everything around it.
And the Meep has brainwashed Sharon and then all these steel mill workers to help build up his ship.
Yes, and there's some soldiers there too who are also the Meep then has to get in this big old high chair, his control chair. We got the little cliffhanger of Sharon trying to attack. I will kill the doctor. That is quickly resolved in the next chapter. It basically he's stopped by going, Sharon, wake up. Okay, I'm awake. And Sharon is very distraught that the Meep is not what he seems to be.
Yes, having sads.
Yes, and the doctor figures out that what the Meep's plan is basically to destroy the Earth to take off. He very cleverly.
So he has to use the black sun, which will this got confusing to me a little bit. So he was going to take off and it was going to suck the black castle into
a black hole.
Yeah. Into a black hole or a time and space vortex thing.
But the doctor very cleverly lowers the power level. So it's only a mini black hole. And the effects are only temporary.
Unknown to the Meep.
This does provide some very good art from Dave Gibbons of some trippy kind of stuff. Things swirling into vortexes. But the Meep thinks he's going to be transported like across the galaxy, but he's really just outside of Earth's atmosphere. And the Wrath can capture him, basically.
Right. They have
big
giant ship. Their ship is bigger than his ship.
And they capture him. He tries to put on his big-eyed, cuteness on Sharon, but she's not going to fall for it again. She's way too smart for that now.
And she gives him a stern scolding.
The Meep will be taken and put into prison, and the doctor will attempt to get to Spain again. And if you think he's in it.
Sharon, apparently.
Yeah, she becomes a little mini companion.
Yes, a grown man with a underage female companion zipping around the universe.
Again, not uncommon for Doctor Who, but he's not that kind of guy, man.
Right. No, yes. Yeah, he's just a fun-loving, asexual.
Yes. Anywho, yes. So he will resume his attempt to get to Spain, which, by the way, he's in England. You would think,
he could just hop the train.
Exactly. Well, the tunnel isn't there yet in 1978, is it?
I don't know.
I think that was built in the, I don't know. Right. I think it was built in the 90s.
You have to take a ferry. But even still, I think that would be easier than
randomly materializing in various places. But yeah, but you know, but therein lies the comedy. This was just a very fun story.
No, I mean, like, again, probably said this as a recommendation comes through. I was laughing at various parts of this, like the part where Fudge tells Sharon that all girls are thickies. Oh, you can't say that, young man.
Yeah, I just, you know, it is very cute. Okay, so I should point out, so Jodie Whittaker just ended her tenure as the 13th Doctor, and the next Doctor will be played by Nkuti Gatwa.
Who's great.
Yeah, who's amazing, and I'm really looking forward to that.
I may actually watch because of him, because his work in Sex Education is really great. He's
just the show Sex Education.
The show Sex Education, also starring the great Gillian Anderson.
Yes. So I'm really looking forward to what he's going to be doing.
Yeah, having him in the show makes me kind of want to watch it.
But before he takes over at the beginning of 2024, there's going to be three specials where David Tennant's going to revise his role for these three specials. And the previews or the trailer for those just came out recently. And we're looking at the trailer, a ship starts to crash into England. And I'm like, that ship looks really familiar. And then a kind of a reveal comes up of a little blue creature. And I was like, oh my God, is that the Meep? And it is. The very first special is going to be called The Star Beast. And they're going to do an adaptation of this.
Well, I asked my Doctor Who coworker fan, I was like, hey, we're reading about the Meep. And he just stared at me blankly.
It is a comic from 1978.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people know about it. I do because I am of that generation.
He ended up having a vague recollection from the comics because he was like, oh, I did read the comics. And I was like, oh, this wasn't in any of the Meep wasn't in any of the shows. And he was like, no. I was like, oh, because I was told this is a very popular character among
maybe Doctor Who fans of a certain age or of a certain obsessive nature, let's say. So anyway, the Meep is going to be in live action, which I am. Oh, my little nerd heart nearly exploded.
It makes me think a little bit of Bebo.
Yes, I can see Bebo. I can see the Bebo comparison.
And actually reading this, there were things in Legends of Tomorrow that reading this, I was like, hey, I feel like maybe Legends of Tomorrow were reading this comic book.
Absolutely. The time travel stuff for sure. There are other, Doctor Who has its, maybe it's not as universally popular as like Star Trek or Star Wars or something like that, but it has its adherents, let's say, some of which were the writers of Bill and Ted. Because, you know, they travel in a box that is the same size on the inside as it is on the outside. So they basically travel in a TARDIS, except the phone booth is the same size as a phone booth.
It's like Doctor Who, but only with more Keanu Reeves.
Whoa. So anyone out there who hasn't read these comics, go out and find them. IDW put together, when they got the rights of Doctor Who have shifted many times over the years, but IDW put out these really great collections of all these comics from Marvel UK. I just say, go out and find it because they're really a lot of fun.
They are. And, you know, it's part of me wants to kind of read some more of them. I don't know if I will invest a ton of time in the Doctor Whoville verse, but
if nothing else, maybe jump on with Nkuti Gatwa and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what's tempting to me because I like that actor a lot. So
yeah,
but man, this was fun reading.
I'm glad. I was a little bit nervous giving it to you because I was like,
written by two legends and illustrated by a legend. You know, it looks great. It reads great.
And you don't really need to know the history of Doctor Who. It helps if you have a
right. There were certain things I skipped over. I don't know what a fizz gig is, but apparently that's a thing. And but it didn't matter. It didn't affect my enjoyment of the comic, which is what's great when you're writing for audiences and the audience can enjoy something without knowing all the references.
If you get it, you get it. If you don't, doesn't hurt the reading experience. So that's it. Doctor Who, greatest show ever in the history of the world. Everyone should go and see it. Start with the revival if you've never seen it before, because the classic series, as great as it is, it's not something you just want to jump into.
Yeah, I don't imagine.
It's very much of its time. And the beauty of the TV show is the fact that the actor changes, and basically every time the actor changes, the show revamps and becomes, like I said, a soft reboot. So you can jump in. If you want to just watch Matt Smith stuff, go for it. If you want to watch Christopher Eccleston, go for it. Doctor Who, great show. Love these comics. And thank you, Brian, for indulging me.
Oh, it was fun. I'm glad I did this.
So that's it. Tell us, Brian, Next time is your choice. What are we going to do in an all-new edition of the Collected Edition?
Well, I think we've had way too much fun in recent podcasts. So, you know, being the person that I am, I want to bring things down a little bit. So for our next podcast, I am recommending Green Lantern, the original run in the 70s, issue 76 to 89, when it was also referred to as on the cover, Green Lantern, Green Arrow. It's a very classic run. Written by Dennis O'Neill and illustrated by Neil Adams, two guys who have some pedigree.
Yeah. Masters so of the craft.
This is actually a collected edition. It's collected into a trade, and it features two of the most or more controversial moments in comic book history.
Okay, it'll be a speedy read.
Yeah, there's two separate issues here that have been discussed ad nauseum,
and we will add to that,
and we will add to that because everybody's waiting for us to weigh in.
Yes, we'll add to that nauseum.
So Green Lantern, it's basically Green Lantern, Green Arrow, familiarly to people out there, but technically Green Lantern, issue 76 to 89.
What an interesting pairing. So it'll be fun to talk about.
Yes, but historically kind of a classic pairing.
Yes, absolutely. You wouldn't think Arrow Guy and Space Guy would go well together, but they do.
But they do.
So anyway, thanks everybody for listening. Of course, we'd love to hear your comments. Go to our website, collectditionpodcast.com, to leave your thoughts on these individual episodes.
Do all the things, follow the instructions at the end.
Exactly. And then also leave a recommendation. I like it. I like when people leave recommendations.
You like recommendations.
Yes. Well, that being said, there's nothing else to say except keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?